Judge Bratfold, Judge Johnson, Judge Bryan, the Honorable Diane B. Bratfold presiding.
Good morning. Let's be seated. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today's date is February 9th, 2023, and we have a total of five matters on our calendar today. Three of those matters are argued orally, and I see the attorneys are here and present for the first matter. So I will ask the marshal to call the first case. And counsel, I'll make just a few quick remarks, probably remarks that you're familiar with, but I just want to make sure. So we're very much looking forward to hearing the argument today. We appreciate having this opportunity to discuss these cases with you. Before you begin your remarks, I want to point out a few things to you. First of all, we do have three available microphones and podiums. It is your choice as to which one you choose to stand at. I'll just point out, obviously, there's some social distancing that's allowed if you take one over the other. The center podium is our traditional podium, and it's adjustable. It goes up and down, and I think you know there's a button available. It also gives you the easiest visibility to the lights, right? So when to see the yellow and the red light is much easier if you're in that center podium. But it's your choice as to where you'd like to stand. And then before you begin your remarks, if you would identify yourself as well as your client, we do make an audio recording of today's proceedings, and that later is available on the court's website. So that helps keep our record clear. And then the last thing I'll say is please do keep an eye on the lights and on the time as it counts down. It tends to go quickly. And as I said again, we enjoy hearing from you. So counsel for appellant, when you're ready, you can begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Scott Rodman, R-O-D-M-A-N. I am the attorney for the appellant, the petitioner in this matter, Christine Salvosa, now known as Christine Pesavento. Your Honors, we are here today because the parties of a minor child have a fundamental disagreement on the interpretation of recommendations received by a parenting consultant appointed pre-decree and subsequently appointed to perform a custody evaluation, making recommendations on physical custody, legal custody, and as to parenting time. The parties have a dispute over certain language that, from the appellant's position, appears to make an award of joint legal custody contingent upon the party's continued long-term use of a parenting consultant to help them resolve disputes.
Does the word long-term appear next to the word continued?
The language, Your Honor, is as follows. It states that I further recommend that the parties share joint legal custody contingent on their continued commitment to a parenting consultant. I am aware of the presumption for sole legal custody, but believe that Cole will benefit from the party's parents' input and standing in the major decisions of Cole's life.
And the word long-term appears on the next page of the document, right?
Correct. Okay. And it states that he further recommends the use of a long-term parenting consultant. As already briefed, it appears that at some point, the party's understanding of what the term long-term meant diverged, but at the time that there was a window to effectively appeal the recommendations of the parenting consultant, once that had passed, it was then made clear that the parties had a disagreement over the operation of the term long-term, as the appellant has indicated to the underlying district court in her affidavit in support of a motion for amended findings in the alternative a new trial or to reopen this matter, indicated the reassurances that she received directly from the parenting consultant as to what he indicated and what his intent was in recommending that an award of joint legal custody be made expressly contingent on that continued utilization of a parenting consultant to help resolve disputes.
And that evidence that you're just referring to is in an affidavit that was filed along with your client's motion for amended findings, correct?
That's correct.
Yeah, so is that properly before us, or is that something on which the district court was obligated to rely on when making its rulings?
Your Honor, the Minnesota Rule of Civil Procedure 59 provides that an additional affidavit providing additional information can be submitted for the court's consideration. It was not part of any trial record because there was no trial that occurred. There was also not an opportunity provided by the district court for either party to be heard on the merits of the issue of legal custody or to submit sworn affidavits or to provide testimony prior to making the decision, as the district court indicated, that one version of a stipulated proposed judgment and decree more closely reflected in the district court's opinion the recommendations of the parenting consultant.
So my recollection is both parties submitted proposed orders, basically, or a proposed amended stipulated judgment and decree. And was there an opportunity at that time to submit additional materials and of any type, whether argumentative or evidentiary? And did any party do so, or was there any prohibition on doing so? Compound question, I know, but I'm trying to understand.
I'll try to answer it as best that I can.
Yeah, that procedure.
Certainly, Your Honor. The court provided each party's attorney an opportunity to submit a brief letter argument that outlined or provided context for the language that was submitted as part of their respective proposed, stipulated, amended judgment and decrees.
Well, counsel, isn't it, they were operating under a PC order too, right? When the district court initially reserves ruling on the custody, refers it to PC, that's pursuant to the agreement of the parties and an order.
That's correct.
If I remember right, it did seem to be tracking along with the model or what folks call the perfect PC order, right?
That is correct. The perfect PC order, I think, was used as a template for the original appointment order, which is an orthodox approach, unusual in family law, to appoint a parenting consultant pre-decree. It's really only reserved for cases that are typically represented by counsel who appreciate that these cases are very high conflict already and are going to require additional assistance in resolving interim disputes.
Well, but to the extent that the PC is doing a custody evaluation, that's pretty routine, pre-decree, to have a custody evaluation done.
To have a custody evaluation, I would disagree that it would be routine to have an appointed parenting consultant.
Okay, but the court, because the parties agreed to it, the court reserved the issue, referred it to a PC. There's nothing in the order that says the PC will determine custody, but rather make recommendations on custody. The PC is also going to determine parenting time, and that's pretty routine as well. Mm-hmm. But I'm asking these questions because, like the perfect PC order, the PC order in this case does include provisions for a party who disagrees with a decision. Or potentially, I guess you could argue that doesn't include the recommendation here on custody. But there is a way to sort of appeal that. And that in that process could have requested an evidentiary hearing.
Correct. And therein lies the fundamental issue of this case, Your Honor. I think you've isolated it. Both parties had an opportunity after receiving the parenting consultant recommendations to either accept them through an act of omission, doing nothing, or to appeal the recommendations directly to the district court. If nothing occurred, no appeal or request for an evidentiary hearing occurred within 30 days, then the agreement of the parties was that the district court would adopt the parenting consultant's recommendations as permanent findings and a decision. However, it was only determined well after the 30-day window had expired, that both parties seemed to have a very fundamentally different understanding of what exactly the parenting consultant was recommending in terms of the term of a the continued use of a parenting consultant.
But in was fact, there a request for an evidentiary hearing once that became apparent?
Once it became apparent that there was a telephone conference with the court where it was suggested that the issue be briefed in the brief letter arguments that I described, and that each party presents competing stipulated amended judgment and decrees.
But was there a request for an evidentiary hearing to determine the issue of permanent custody that had been previously reserved?
Not at that time, because the court had outlined a process to submit written arguments. An evidentiary hearing was requested as part of the motion for amended findings, new trial, or reopening at that point. This was an unusual approach to try to resolve a case. I think it's a function of two experienced family law attorneys who were trying to be creative to help resolve a case that was likely headed for trial on the issues of physical and legal custody as well as parenting time, to try to find a way to resolve that without the expense associated with the trial. In hindsight, there were blind spots, clearly. We wouldn't be here today if not for them. And as a result, the district court welcomed competing versions of what was termed a stipulated amended judgment and decree, accepted written letter argument, but not testimony or sworn statements from either party, and then selected one of them and then issued an order indicating that it's a stipulated amended judgment.
Was there a dispute about the custody label?
There was a dispute over whether or not joint legal custody should be made contingent upon the use of a parenting consultant through the minor child's emancipation. My client was comfortable, and only comfortable, with agreeing through omission, not appealing, to the district court, an award of joint legal custody so long as the parties would have this ADR process available to them.
Again, I didn't want to take up all the time, but it seems like if that's the case, that it's contingent upon something that exceeds 2 years, it's essentially contingent upon an agreement, but, right? Because the court can't order a PC against the agreement of the party. That has to be something the parties contract to, right?
That is accurate, but what a court can do is adopt an agreement of the parties that would exceed the scope of the authority that a court would normally have. That there's well-settled case law that it can go beyond that as long as the parties have agreed. In this matter, all the parties agreed to was that the recommendations of the parenting consultant would be adopted as the order of the court if neither side appealed. Neither side appealed, and only subsequent to that did it become clear that there was not a meeting of the minds, and in fact there was mutual mistake on the issue of the term of the parenting consultant's continued involvement. The reality in the district court adopting one party's interpretation is in fact a tacit acknowledgement that there was not a meeting of the minds. The district court made findings that in fact the parties do not agree as to what long term is, and therefore the court can't impose a term longer than 2 years if that's the minimum that the parties agreed to.
How is it any different from parties agreeing with the mediator, let's say, to use a PC and then showing up in court and one party's like, yeah, I don't agree to that. I never agreed to that. And at that point, the court's hands are tied. The court can't order a PC, right? Isn't that the same thing that could happen here? Is that when they ultimately show up in court, one party is saying that's not what I agreed to, and so you don't have a signed PC agreement?
In the scenario that you describe, Your Honor, no, the court couldn't do anything. In the absence of perhaps a binding mediation agreement or a signed stipulation, they couldn't. But in this matter, the parties had already entered into a stipulation to appoint a parenting consultant, and they had entered into a stipulation that they would agree to abide by those recommendations of the parenting consultant. Therefore, the court could have entered the language as proposed by the appellant if it had the understanding that all of the language in the parenting consultant's recommendations, including long-term, including continued commitment to the use of a parenting consultant, were all in fact operative. The court could have found that the parties agreed to all of this language and interpreted it to mean that the parenting consultant intended the parenting consultant process to be utilized through the minor child's emancipation. Instead, it simply interpreted it that the use of long-term or continued commitment is unclear, and so the district court was going to side with the interpretation of the respondent.
Yeah, I guess typically the order, the PC order, is signed by the parties and then brought to the court. So wouldn't that step have to be in place if there were going to be a long-term PC agreement? It's not enough for the PC to make a, I further recommend the parties stay committed. Wouldn't the parties themselves have to submit a signed PC order that would be long-term with both signatures that says it is agreed the agreement may be approved by the court, just like every other PC order?
There are scenarios, Your Honor, where a court does essentially impose the continued use of a parenting consultant upon parties. If the original appointment order or the underlying order that indicated the party's agreement to use a PC had a term through the emancipation or through 2 years, once you agree to use a parenting consultant and for a specific term, if you then decide you no longer want to work with the parenting consultant, the district court can absolutely enforce your continued utilization of that process. In this scenario, if the recommendations from the parenting consultant in fact were long-term and that should mean through the child's emancipation, then the district court could have interpreted that. I'm sorry, I see that I'm out of time.
Please complete your answer. Go ahead.
The district court could have interpreted that as requiring a long-term use and then submitted an order that contained a term through the minor child's emancipation.
Judge Bryan, do you want to follow up?
No, thank you.
Any other questions from the panel? Thank you, counsel. And, of course, you know you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
I'm aware. Thank you, Your Honor.
Very good. Counsel for respondent, we're ready for you.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Joanna Clyborn, and I represent the respondent, Alan Douglas Savosa. Respondent requests humbly that this court affirm the district court's order and the underlying amended judgment and decree. Both are procedurally sound and follow the law. Hindsight is always 20/20. If the court had added the provisions that appellant asks, the court would have been outside of the statutory authority it was granted. First off, the court appropriately found that it did not have the ability to deviate from 518.18 delta paren 1, which changed the standard of review in the case to a best interest standard. Minnesota statute 645.1 clearly instructs that the words of the law, when they are clear from all ambiguity, the language of the statute controls. 518.18D is very clear on its face. The judgment and decree does not show that the parties or any stipulation there before agreed to having a best interest standard apply under 518.17. Similarly, the appellant's suggestion that the use of a long-term parenting consultant until the child reached the age of majority would have also violated statute. The court is correct in noting that the decision made by the PC says that the long-term schedule should be. but then goes on to provide, I further recommend that the parties share joint legal custody, continuing on their commitment to a PC. The court in its order directly noted that while it is after his part of decision, he specifically says, while not specifically part of this order, I further recommend that. If Mr. Goldfarb had in fact intended to be included as part of his older order and ultimate decision that the long-term PC would be to the age of majority, it would have a different result and we would not be here. However, the court did thoroughly review both the PC's order, the decision, the agreements by the party, and it did enter an order consistent with the recommendations of the PC. The parenting consultant is a statutory construct, and it cannot be appointed or ordered over the agreements of the parties. There is no agreement or nor anywhere in the PC report that says that this should go to the child's age of 18.
Counsel, if I could interrupt, because I'm trying to understand as best I can the role of this particular PC. It does seem that there was sort of a dual role. Like on one hand, the PC is doing a parenting evaluation and recommendations about custody, permanent custody in the first instance, not a modification, but in the first instance because it was reserved, right? And at the same time, performing the more traditional role of a PC, which isn't related to permanent custody labels because that's something that typically is excluded from what the PCs can do. So help me understand, in this particular case, this dual role, if you agree with it, that characterization, that the PC performed.
Yes, Your Honor. I agree with the appellant's attorney. Both attorneys were trying to avoid trial and find a creative way for these parties forward. The parties stipulated prior to the entry of the judgment and decree to the use of a parenting consultant to help do a quasi-custody evaluation and to provide recommendations as to the issue of custody and parenting, or as to custody and parenting time. The model PC was used with the exception of one change. Instead of the standard 14-day provision, there was a 30-day provision added in order to give both parties ample time to review the recommendations of the PC. And if they didn't have an agreement or if there was not a clear understanding of what it meant, they could appeal. It is undisputed that neither party appealed the PC's recommendations and that those were adopted by the court.
Is it fair to characterize their agreement to use the PC in this way as essentially saying the PC's recommendations will be final? The PC will, in that way, if it's not appealed, the PC's recommendations bind the court's reserved permanent legal custody decision. Is that a fair characterization? Because that, I think, to me, it also is a little bit different than what I've typically seen when parties mediate or use a PC or a parenting evaluation. But it seems like that's the characterization I'm getting from opposing counsel, is that there was some agreement that these recommendations would bind the district court's decision on permanent custody.
That is correct, Your Honor. The parties freely and willingly entered into a stipulation for that to occur. However, given that the district court never truly loses its ability to focus on the best interest of the child, that decision from the PC could have been appealed. It was not appealed and therefore became, by stipulation of the parties, binding. Nothing had changed. In fact, the court had noted in reviewing its orders that the parties actually had renewed the contract with a new parenting consultant after Mr. Goldfarb completed his recommendations and withdrew as the parenting consultant.
If I could follow up on that point, because I think that's in the addendum with Ms. Jamieson, and it does appear that there's a term in that agreement regarding the length of the PC engagement that seems to be different than the initial one with Mr. Goldfarb. Is that important for us as we look at, both said 2 years, but the PC order that I think you're referring to with Ms. Jamieson said if they want to extend it, it has to be in writing by mutual agreement, and that's not included in the agreement with Mr. Goldfarb.
That is correct, Your Honor, because Mr. Goldfarb's appointment as a PC was intended to do a traditionally not something we delegate to parenting consultants. But as under 114, the parties are free to craft alternate support resolutions that best fit their case. Ms. Jamison's PC order does recognize the fact that they are subject to an agreement. That parenting consultant order also follows along with the parties are not ordered or cannot be ordered subject outside of their agreement to the continued use of a parenting consultant. With that said, the other issues that we have, of course, before the court.
One more question about that, and maybe you can remind us of the sequence. Again, the order of when the Jamison agreement is signed as opposed to when the district court receives these arguments from parties, or the proposed stipulations, I should say.
Yes, Your Honor. The actual assignment of Ms. Jamison occurred before the request for amended findings. In fact, Ms. Jamison occurred before the court issued its original stipulated judgment and decree, I believe. I can double-check the dates of the orders, but I'm near positive of that. And so prior to the court issuing its amended or request for the amended, there already was a new parenting consultant on the case. And so that's where the court got the continued intent to use a PC and that they were, in fact, committed to the use of a parenting consultant. But the court, again, correctly noted that it does not have the authority, and nor does it include anywhere in the original PC Mr. Goldfarb's recommendation, until the age of 18. That's kind of a specific requirement that would have been annotated within his order. And so it is absent from that. And the shoulda, woulda, coulda is really not necessarily before this court. The fact is that an appeal could have been made at the time or clarification could have been sought from Mr. Goldfarb, and it was not. Further, when we went into the amended motion and we went into the amended findings, the affidavit that Your Honor referred to earlier was, in fact, inappropriately before the court. And so that has to do with Rule 52.02. The affidavit for amended findings contained new information. And the request was made to strike that information because it wasn't in the record before the court. And additionally, under Rule 59 of civil procedure, the request for the new trial, there was never a trial in the first place on the issue because the parties, again, had stipulated to the court and its findings being made as a result of written submissions. And so when we look at that, a motion for a new trial is really an anomaly when there's been no trial. And except for a few post-decree proceedings that constitute a trial, there is no right to a new trial. In fact, in the case of Husso v. Husso, the court found that a trial for a post-decree spousal maintenance modification was improper because there had been no underlying trial.
Does it make a difference that this is in the initial? It's not a modification motion. This is still the party's initial dissolution decree, and there was a component that just got reserved, and further, attempts to mediate, I guess, or to have an evaluation to help the parties decide parenting time and permanent custody. Does that make a difference? It certainly makes a difference in terms of the best interest findings and versus, the modification standard. But
in this case, it does not, because there was a subsequent agreement by the parties, right? Not court-directed, but an agreement by the parties to submit their arguments in writing, and that the court would base its findings on what was submitted in writing. So effectually, they did have a trial, but it was in a version of written format versus appearing and calling witnesses. And so in that particular case, a trial had been had in that the court had submissions of evidence, but there was no evidentiary hearing demanded at that time. Furthermore, the court followed the agreement of the parties to submit. And so as we do sometimes with spousal maintenance issues or modifications and still having a trial, we've actually had cases similar where a custody modification was submitted by written stipulation. And this, again, the parties in their November 10th specifically put forward how they were going to, in the November 10th, 2020 stipulated agreement, how they were going to move forward for the court's consideration, along with that letter brief that outlined at each of the parties' considerations on the position of what the parenting consultant order meant, whether there should be a new trial or whether there should be anything further other than what each party proposed in their proposed findings. The court, yes, Your Honor.
So, go ahead.
I was going to switch topics a little bit, yes. Which is you made an argument in your responsive brief about res judicata and collateral estoppel. Did you present that argument to the district court below, and did the district court rule on it in any way, either orally or in writing?
It was presented to the district court in a memorandum of law, Your Honor. The court did not.
And at what stage or what time of in these proceedings?
It was based on the request for a new trial. And I could double-check the timeline on that, but the request for a new trial and amended findings came in, and then when we submitted our response, there was a memorandum of law submitted as part of that, okay. In which I did raise the issues of res judicata and collateral estoppel, Your Honor.
And then did the district court specifically rule on that?
It did not, Your Honor.
So, counsel, I was going to ask you as well, in your since your time is going, to touch on one other topic. So the motion to reopen based on equitable grounds, I don't see any discussion in the district court's order, and it's understandable why not, but I need to ask, any discussion of the best interest factors in the children for the child in making this initial custody determination? And normally that is something we would see. Is that a valid grounds to reopen, and would you touch on that? Thank you.
Sure. It is not, because the purpose of the parenting consultant was to go through those factors, in which, in fact, in the parenting consultant.
But normally a district court, if they received a recommendation, would, and like you said, we're in a context where the parties have agreed to written submissions, we'd still see determinations by the district court, because down the line, there may be a future motion, and we need some sort of a baseline in the record. And when I say we, I am saying the judiciary generally, the next district court judge or the next referee, whoever's involved in the case.
Acknowledged, Your Honor. So it does occur in the amended findings where the court walks through the proposals of or the findings of the parenting consultant as to whether it lays out specifically one or the other. It does not touch on that merely because the parties agreed to the findings in the PC order, which then becomes part of the record. However, the court did not, in its amended finding, walk through the parenting consultants found this.
Do you have the specific reference you'd like us to rely on for that, or you just want to?
The case law, Your Honor, for that?
No, I'm asking where do you, so if I'm following you, you're saying that the district court effectively incorporated the PC's analysis of the best interest factors.
Yes, Your Honor.
Right, okay. And is there specific language you'd point to, or perhaps you did that in your brief and I should just look there?
It's actually within the court's order itself, Your Honor.
I know, that's what I'm asking you. Can you identify it for it? And if you can't, that's fine.
I cannot, Your Honor,
okay,
at this time. So with that, Your Honor, I see my time is
and
up.
You, when you say that, if I may.
Yes, please.
I'm kind of scrolling through and trying to refresh my recollection of the amended decree. You're talking about the it should be in italics. Some best interest factors, I should be able to find that pretty quickly, both for the permanent custody decision, but also the parenting time decision.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay. Anything further from the panel? All right. And counsel, thank you very much for your argument.
Thank you, Your Honor, and thank you for your engaged questions in this discussion. I'm going to try to be as laser focused on simply a rebuttal, much as I'd love to go into all of the arguments I had prepared. To the argument that the parent consultant was appointed for 2 years, I would argue based on practice that is not long term.
Right, but I think the question I was asking about Ms. Jamison's order,
mm-hmm.
Which was filed by the court in April of 2021, November is the status conference. Many months later is the status conference where the parties are told to submit proposed amended to address the Goldfarb report, right? So you have an agreement months before November that says the parties agree to 2 years with Ms. Jamieson. If they want to extend, it must be by mutual written agreement. So it seems like that is inconsistent with an understanding that there was an agreement to something longer than 2 years, because you signed and filed, or not you, but the party signed and filed a PC order with Ms. Jamieson for two, and that added piece that's not in the Goldfarb agreement.
Hopefully I can provide some additional context for you, Your Honor. At the time that Ms. Jamieson was appointed, the parties were both at that time and counsel of the understanding that there was a complete agreement. There was no dispute over the term long-term or what that would mean. The reason why Ms. Jamieson was appointed is because of the peculiarities here, where Mr. Goldfarb only agreed to conduct a custody evaluation if that was his swan song on this case. He was not comfortable continuing work as a neutral after he's been asked to make evaluative opinions. So this was still pre-decree, as Your Honor noted. As a result, the original parenting consultant or stipulation appointing Mr. Goldfarb was still operative. They were still required, if for any reason that PC was no longer willing to serve, to find an alternative parenting consultant. Names were provided per the protocol. Ms. Jamieson was selected. Ms. Jamieson has an internal professional policy, as many do, that they only want appointment orders to be specific for 2 years, because that's the term of their contract. That does not mean that the underlying order couldn't say through the parties, the minor child's emancipation. It just means you've got to renew every two. So that's the context of what occurred. It was long after Ms. Jamieson's appointment that the parties realized that there was not an agreement to utilize a parenting consultant through the minor child's emancipation. And in fact, what's clear in the affidavit submitted pursuant to the motion for amended findings at all is that Mr. Salvosa indicated strongly, if he had been led to believe that the recommendations from Mr. Goldfarb involved him having to consent to the utilization of a parent consultant process through the minor child's emancipation, one that he was already complaining loudly about, that he would have immediately appealed the decision to the district court. This demonstrates both parties had a fundamental mutual mistake over what that meant. Furthermore, with respect to the issues of res judicata is inapplicable in this scenario because Minnesota Statute Section 518.14 explicitly provides an avenue for a court to reopen. It's entitled Decree Finality Reopening, to reopen under certain circumstances. And that is, in fact, where the motion was made. And to the other questions regarding the courts making specific findings as to the best interests of the child, that never occurred. I think the court's review of the applicable orders will demonstrate, in fact, that the court never made those findings. And as the court is well aware, it is well settled case law that the best interests of the child are the central focus of the case, of paramount importance. These are quotes lifted from the various case law, that even in the circumstances where there is a stipulation, the district court still needs to exercise independent judgment and make detailed findings as to why incorporating the language as proposed is in the child's best interest, and that did not occur.
Judge Bradfield.
Thank you very much for your time.
Just one moment, question. Counsel. Sure. Yeah, go right ahead.
With respect to the first issue, the main issue, your opposing counsel has cited us a non-precedential case called McGraw v. McGraw. I'm wondering whether you think that decision was correctly decided, and if so, or if not, well, if so, how it would apply to this case.
I'm trying to bring it up right now, Your Honor, just to...
I
Excuse me, Your Honor. In this case, I believe it is distinguishable because the parties bound themselves only to utilize a parenting consultant for 2 years, and that the district court found that it could not impose a continuing use of a parenting consultant after the party's initial agreement to utilize one for a term of 2 years. The distinction in this case is that the original appointment for a PC was pre-decree, essentially to help resolve interim high conflict. The subsequent PC appointment was still pre-decree and made at a time where the appellant's understanding was that the final order would include language that joint legal custody was contingent on the party's continuing commitment to the use of a long-term parenting consultant.
Thank you, counsel. Our thanks both lawyers in this case. The matter is well briefed and argued. It is now submitted to the court for a decision. We will issue a written decision within the statutory time frame. Thank you.
Thank you very much.